It is 1:06, and this is the House Judiciary Committee, and we are now convened. Present with us today are Representative Lynn, Representative Grunberg, Vice Chair Keller, and myself, Chair Ledoux. Please turn off your cell phones. We have two items before us today. They're both new bills. The first one that we are going to hear is SB 43, Immunity for Fire Department and Members, sponsored by Senator Coghill. And we also have HB 125, Restrictions on the Sale of Dextromethorphan, by the Judiciary Committee's own Representative Cherise Millett. I believe that we can move both bills out today, but I'm crossing my fingers just in case. We will not be hearing SB 30 today, but that bill will be the only item of business for our next hearing. So, first up.
Next Wednesday, right?
No, Friday.
Friday. So, first up is SB 43, and I think we've got Jordan Schilling here, who virtually lives in this room.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. Senator Coghill looks like he won't be able to make it. He's in a leadership meeting, so I think I'm flying solo. For the record, Jordan Schilling, staff to Senator Coghill. This bill, Senate Bill 43, addresses a problem that the Fairbanks North Star Borough brought to our attention this interim, and it relates to contract fire departments. That's what we rely on in the Fairbanks North Star Borough. We've got five contract fire departments that serve the borough and surrounding areas. And we immediately began working with the borough to craft some legislation. They've made it a priority. We've also been working with the municipality of Anchorage because it affects them as well. There are two contract departments that serve the municipality. That would be the Chugach Fire Department and the Girdwood Fire Department. So government creates immunities for itself in all sorts of areas. It's a fairly common thing to do, especially when it comes to public safety and fire departments in particular. So most states have a statute that you know, protects the fire departments themselves and the fire departments. Well, we have a similar statute. It's AS 0965070. And that bill provides that immunity that I just spoke of, but there's an inequity in that statute because it doesn't cover those contract departments I just spoke of. So we did a little bit of legwork looking into the history of that statute. It was established in the mid-70s. It's not clear to us if there were even contract departments in existence in the 70s. And it was crafted after they actually took the language from a statute in Delaware, and they just worked it into ours.
Yep. Jordan, so when you say contract fire departments, are we talking about volunteer fire departments? Are they all volunteer that are contract?
Thank you, Madam Chair. These are 501c3s. These are nonprofits. They are mostly volunteer-based. There are some paid members. You know, the chief, for example, is generally going to be paid. But, yeah, mostly volunteer-based.
Thank you. And Representative Klayman has joined us.
It's good to be here.
Good to have you, Representative Klayman. Proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So because, you know, the municipality, the Fairbanks North Star Borough and the municipality of Anchorage contract with these departments, utilize their services, and the statute doesn't cover them, those municipalities are exposed to extra liability that other municipalities aren't. So are those fire departments, and so are those firefighters that work or volunteer there. So this bill simply extends that immunity to those departments. The bill went through two committees in the other body. There were changes made to the bill in both committees. The first change to the bill was, as introduced, the bill created a total immunity. And there was some concern about creating just a real blanket immunity like that. So what we did is we made an exception to that immunity for gross negligence and willful acts of misconduct. That's a fairly common carve-out in immunity statutes. For example, our 911 system immunity statute has the same carve-out. And then the second change to the bill, really just to address a concern of Representative Seaton's in this body, was just to ensure that this immunity does not somehow apply to a department that has a contract with a private entity. Just as kind of a safeguard, that change was made.
Does so, not apply to?
To, if there were, for example, let's just say a village was had a relationship with a contract department, and let's just say that department had a subsequent contract with some kind of private entity. We just wanted to make sure that this bill didn't somehow protect a private entity like that. So we weren't sure if the change was absolutely necessary. We did it anyway, just as a safeguard.
That's what I was trying to ask you before, whether this only covered contracts with 501c organizations. Or
yeah, that's correct. These are mostly structured like that. Yep.
All right. Thank you. And Representative Millett has now joined
us.
Apologies for being late. So, any questions for Representative Grunberg?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't see the previous statute here in the packet, because this is a repeal and reenact statute here. Section 1. Section 2 just seems to be a conforming thing, and the real thing is in Section 1.
That's correct.
I see Chief Fullenweider's letter here, and it says, these bills, second paragraph, second sentence, these bills, if enacted, will protect residents by reducing the risk of liability and frivolous tort claims against municipal and nonprofit fire agencies. Now, what does this bill do to change the liability of the municipality itself?
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, and I don't have the letter in front of me.
Here, I'll give it to you.
But to your question, Representative Grunberg, what does this do to the municipally operated fire departments?
That's what he says there, and I want to know what it is.
Yeah, the municipally operated departments like Anchorage Fire Department, for example, that's where I see this letter's coming from, they already do have some protections in statute. This doesn't do a whole lot to affect those. If anything, it extends their protections a little bit, but certainly doesn't reduce it.
May I continue, please?
Go ahead.
Are we going to have anybody from the municipal fire department on the line? Okay, because I want to ask them, I want a more specific answer. If it's a little bit, I want to know how little and what it does. I'll just ask the chief, though.
All right, very good. We have any other questions for Mr. Schilling?
Yes, I do have one.
Go ahead, Representative Grunberg.
We are going to see a bill shortly that I will not name that gets into the issue of retroactivity. This bill, and I want it clear on the record through the chair, is not retroactive and will only apply to claims arising on or after the effective date of this act, right?
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, that's correct. There's not an applicability section here, so it would apply.
I'm serving notice that I may offer an applicability section. I realize to state just what I've said, that this applies to claims arising on or after the effective date of the act. I apologize. I may have violated the 24-hour rule, but I think it's important that we make it really clear.
And Madam Chair, if I may, I believe the drafter of the bill in Ledge Legal is on the line to see if that would be a necessary change. It may be that this just inherently only applies to claims on or after.
Madam Chair, the reason I'm doing that is because now routinely they do that in criminal laws. But we haven't seen this issue arrive before this committee this year on the civil tort situation.
All right. Well, did you say the drafter was on the line?
Madam Chair, she may be. Susie Schutz.
Okay. Well, actually, I'd like you to get the drafter. Somebody get the drafter. Okay, great. She's not on the line now, but maybe we can get her there. Any other questions at the moment? Okay, we have on the line, we have Mitch Flynn from the Steese Volunteer Fire Department, and we also to testify, and we also have David Gibbs and Jill from Anchorage, the Director of Emergency Services, and Jill Nolan from Fairbanks North Star Borough to answer any questions. So if there are no further questions at the moment for Mr. Schilling, I'd like to open public testimony.
I'm sorry, did you say there was somebody from Anchorage?
Well, I did say there was somebody from Anchorage because it says Community Anchorage, and then it says Directory Emergency Services Fairbanks North Star Borough. So it's kind of confusing. So we're going to have to ask that person. So to begin with, we've got Mitch Flynn from Anchorage, from Fairbanks. Mr. Flynn, do you want to identify yourself for the record, tell us whom you are representing, and you can proceed to testify.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is Mitch Flynn. I'm the Fire Chief of the Spies Volunteer Fire Department, a nonprofit organization in Fairbanks. And we provide both fire and EMS services under contract with Fairbanks North Star Borough. This past year, the borough brought to our attention the lack of immunity protection that we as a contractor have and can make us vulnerable to lawsuits. And that, in the end, then can result in the taxpayer that we serve being liable for large claims. So we're asking for a change in Alaska statute that will provide the same immunity protection to our department members that also municipalities currently have for their employees today. And we have identified approximately 7 nonprofit fire departments statewide that contract to municipal governments to provide the services of fire and EMS to a population base of approximately 100,000 residents. And now that this problem has been brought to our attention, we have a concern about the lack of community protection, and it may have a negative impact on recruitment and retention of volunteers in the future unless we can have this problem addressed. And on one good note about this, by passing this legislation, it may help reduce our cost and annual premiums for general liability insurance that we pay out. And then the irony of this is in my department, and I'm fire chief of a combination paid and volunteer members, but we find ourselves in a position of a higher liability risk when we mutual aid into an area like this body, city of Fairbanks, where they're protected, have better protection of immunity than what we have. We can be responding to their call and then incur a liability claim. And so there's some equities there. We're both serving the taxpayer, and it is our desire to be able to do that safely and to best our ability without the fear of lawsuits and unwanted claims happening. So that's the situation we find ourselves in. And like I said, the borough legal team up here in Fairbanks is one that has discovered this, and we are addressing that concern. And I take any questions anybody has.
Does anybody have any questions for Mr. Flynn? All right, well, Mr. Flynn, thank you very much for your testimony. The second person that we have online for testimony is Doug Schrage. Doug, would you please identify yourself for the record and tell us who you're representing, and then you can proceed with your testimony.
Yes, good afternoon. Thank you, Madam Chair Ledoux. My name is Doug Schrage. I am calling as a representative of the Alaska Fire Chiefs Association, and I would like to thank you for hearing this bill and also to Mr. Schilling for presenting on it. In my professional capacity, I'm the fire chief at the University of Alaska Fairbanks Fire Department. I'm a current board member and past president of the Alaska Fire Chiefs Association, and we represent most of the fire and emergency service leaders throughout the state. And I joined Chief Flynn and my other local colleagues and those of the Alaska Fire Chiefs Association in supporting this bill. The University Fire Department, like the Steese Fire Department and several others, are a student-based nonprofit fire department, and we provide fire protection to the North Star Borough on a contractual basis. And as such, we are not a municipal fire department, and we, too, would benefit from the immunity that this bill affords. In particular concern to us is that we are a workforce development program responsible for providing many of Alaska's municipal fire departments with experienced and trained firefighters. But in this current fiscal environment at the university, concern over the liability that this bill addresses could be a factor in the future of our program. And for those reasons, I join my other colleagues in supporting this bill, and I would urge your support as well. And thank you again very much.
Thank you. Do we have any questions for Mr. Shragi? Yes, Representative Klayman.
Chief Shragi, just in terms of if this bill passes, what does that mean it looks like for a non-municipal fire department such as yours in terms of where there would be where there would be potential liability and where there wouldn't be with this passage of the bill?
Well, what this bill, by my understanding, is it extends to fire departments such as ours the same sort of protection from immunity from liability under the doctrine of sovereign immunity to us non-municipal fire departments. We're contractors, and since we are therefore independent of the municipal or borough government, those immunities don't extend to us or to our employees. And so our exposure to just general immunity is enormous in terms of nonfeasance or failure to provide service, all the way to injury to my employees, and maybe a failure to protect the citizens who pay our taxes. So, my understanding is that this bill would specifically address those sorts of immunities.
And just one follow-up.
Yes, so
one way to look at it would be that right now municipalities have greater protections when it's actually municipal employees working, because they would have the protections as the sovereign, whereas as a volunteer fire department that is not a municipality, they could actually be exposed to negligence liability for the work they're doing rather than their gross negligence protection that is currently afforded municipalities in the same setting.
Yes, sir, through the chair, that is my understanding.
Thank you.
Yes, Representative Grunberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Shragi, and if there are other people who are going to be more able to answer these questions, I don't mean to put you on the spot. You're a great guy, and that you just happen to be in the hot seat. Are you familiar with what this bill legally does?
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, I believe on sort of an elementary level, I am. I am not intimately familiar with the nuances and the effects of the various substitute versions and amendments that have been subjected to, but I have a basic understanding of what this bill does.
Thank you. I will not ask you. We're going to need to have some other witnesses on. This bill does quite a bit.
Okay. Do you want to ask any of the other two people that we've got on the line, Mr. Gibbs or Jung Dolan?
Who are they?
I'm not sure. Jung Dolan is from the Fairbanks North Star Borough, and David Gibbs is the Director of Emergency Services for either Anchorage or the Fairbanks North Star Borough.
No, it says FBX.
I know, but it also says Community Anchorage.
And Madam Chair, if I may, I think Jill Dolan, who's the Assistant Borough Attorney, I'm just guessing, but I think that's who Representative Grunberg would need to ask some of those difficult legal questions to.
Well, I'll try with you.
All right. Jim, are you there?
Hi, this is Jill Dolan. Yes, I'm online.
Yes, and can you identify yourself? Are you an attorney, Jim?
Yes, So I am an assistant borough attorney for the Fairbanks North Star Borough, and then Mr. Gibbs is our emergency operations director. He's currently in Anchorage. That's where he's calling in from, but he is a Fairbanks North Star Borough employee.
All right. Would you like to ask these questions to Ms. Dolan?
I would prefer if we could get somebody else, because there are things that don't apply probably too much in Fairbanks. I'd rather get one of our legal counsel or AG or somebody from Anchorage. This bill does quite a bit.
The drafter is online.
The drafter is online.
Who is
that?
Susan
Schutz.
What? How does she spell her last name?
At ease. Okay, Ms. Dolan, are you still there?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay. Representative Grunberg has a few questions for you.
Through the chair. First of all, the members to follow me need to have a copy of the actual current law and the judiciary CS. And we're focusing on subsection C only. Ms. Dolan, do you have those documents in front of you, or are they available to you for my questions?
Yes, I have those.
It looks to me like the first sentence of the section, everything's going to relate to section one here. And the first sentence of section one is essentially the same as the current law. It's just a little more elegantly drafted to read a little better. Am I right?
Yes, Representative, I believe you are correct. And what substantively changes that section is the definition of fire department that appears on, it begins on lines 13 and 14.
Well, before we anticipate my questions, let me just ask them, because I'm going to be going ahead looking at the second sentence of this, which reestablishes the liability of of an employee. Well, it looks to me like the first sentence deals with an action on line six or omission of an employee. So in other words, if I sue Joe Fireman because he dropped me and said burn, I couldn't, that's what it applies. But if I sue the fire department, that's where the second sentence comes in, because it says on lines 10 and 11 may not be maintained against the fire department. So I think that's the essential difference between the first sentence and the second sentence. The first sentence is an action against the employee. The second is an action against the fire department. Am I correct, ma'am?
You're correct, with the additional qualification that if the action is against a fire department, you can still have an action if it alleges intentional misconduct or gross negligence.
Yeah, you're one step ahead of me. That's right.
Okay, I'll slow down.
Right now, under the current law, you can sue the fire department for negligence. This immunizes the fire department itself, whether or not it's volunteer, even if it's the New York City, the Anchorage, Fairbanks, whatever it is, you can no longer sue them unless the action alleges intentional misconduct or gross negligence. And that I think was...
Can you let her? I think she's trying to comment here.
I was just going to say, could I finish my sentence?
So there's currently in law, and so in subsection D of current 0965070, there is for municipal fire departments discretionary function immunity for damages. So you cannot currently maintain an action for damages against a municipal fire department if it's based on a discretionary function. Now, that same immunity does not apply to the contracted fire department, such as what Chief Flynn and Chief Schrage were discussing, because they're contracted fire departments. So the intent was to incorporate a similar immunity into subsection C for those fire departments.
May I please?
Yes, let me actually interject something here, and then I'll go back to you. Discretionary immunity, though, Ms. Dolan, means if they decided, you can't sue them because they decide not to exercise a function, like, let's say, the Department of Transportation here. If somebody doesn't put up a guardrail, you can't sue the state. But if they put up a guardrail and they don't maintain the guardrail, then you can sue them, because the first is discretionary, and you can't sue a government for not doing something which is discretionary. But you can sue them for negligence in something which they decide to undertake. So now I'm getting confused here.
No, I think you're absolutely correct. So discretionary functions are generally aspects involving allocation of financial resources. And you're right, once you undertake a duty, you generally can't undertake it in a non-negligent manner. But there are certain on-the-scene decisions in firefighting that could be discretionary because they entail resource allocation. So because those, you know, decisions are vested in the fire chief that would be in charge. So so the courts have extended some discretionary function immunity in the context of fire that would include on the scene decisions.
Yeah, continue.
Go back.
Okay. So discretionary actions are immunized. We're only talking here, folks, about non-discretionary. And as I read this, under current law, if you sue the fire department, the government itself, rather than the individual, for non-discretionary, the standard is negligence. And here, because on line 11, it says intentional or gross negligence. That is now the standard, and I believe that was added in one of the committees of referral. Looking at the notes, it was in the CNR. It was not in the original bill. And that was added in the Senate CNRA committee. And that significantly raises the standard for suing a fire department that's totally professional, involved in a non-discretionary function. Ms. Dolan, is that right?
It changes the standard, yes, for the non-discretionary functions. But the intent was, because contracted fire departments can't enjoy discretionary function immunity, the intent was to still leave subsection D intact and allow municipalities to continue to enjoy that immunity. And instead, in the context of looking at fire departments in general, extend an immunity that wouldn't be a full and complete immunity, but would limit it. And so the intentional misconduct or gross negligence language is intended to limit how far that immunity could extend. It wasn't intended to expand the immunity when I listened in to the committee substitute.
Yeah, please continue. I want to take a look at this a little bit because, okay, I think it goes farther. As I said, in Oklahoma, it's gone about as far as you can go, and I don't want to do that. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll leave it at that.
All right. I'm actually going to hold this bill because it looks like, from my listening of this conversation, that it appears that this bill may go further than it was the original intent of the sponsor to go.
Madam Chair, I can probably speak a little bit to the original intent. This is how it was upon introduction, Representative Grunberg. The non-discretionary immunity to non-discretionary activities for fire departments was how it was upon introduction. The only thing that the Community Regional Affairs Committee did was do that carve out for intentional misconduct or gross negligence. So that was the intention all along, was to expand that immunity.
I think we need to look at it and make sure it does what you want. Thank you.
So, any other questions for Ms. It looks like we've got Ms. Schutz back on, or we have her. She's the legislative legal.
I'd like to thank Ms. Dolan. Thank you for taking the hot seat. I didn't mean to put you on the spot.
All right. Well, I think we have finished the public testimony for anyone online right now. And is there anybody in the audience who would like to testify? Well, then I am going to close public testimony, and I'm going to hold this bill, and we're going to...
I'll help with you.
Thank you. Thank you, Jordan. All right, next up is Representative Willett's bill.
Yay!
So that's HB 125, and I'm not even going to bother to say again that I'm hoping that this bill is going to get out, because one never knows what's going to happen. Representative Keller.
I would recommend that if Grace can't say dextromorphin three times, methamphetamine three times.
Oh, she can say it like that.
Then we set the bill aside.
Well, let's see if Representative Millett can say it.
Dextromethorphan.
Very good.
Thank you.
Very good. Okay, 125. So,
bless
it
you.
Looks like Grace Abbott is here to present on behalf of the bill sponsor, Representative Millett. So please put yourself on the record and brief the committee on what your bill does.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair. For the record, Grace Abbott, staff to Representative Charisse Millett. Madam Chair, thank you so much for hearing House Bill 125. As you can see, this bill deals with a long word that my boss pronounced so beautifully, but a modest concept. For decades, families like mine and probably yours as well have been using over-the-counter cough medicines to treat our coughs and colds. Many of these medicines have contained dextromethorphan, or DXM. When used correctly, Madam Chair, medicines with DXM are safe and effective in soothing our symptoms. However, when taken in high doses, these medicines can produce hallucinations, confusion, blurred vision, nausea, excessive fatigue, and loss of motor control. To you and I, these sound like horrible side effects that are easily avoided by taking the recommended dose. But unfortunately, according to a 2013 study, 4% of teenagers, 8th graders through 12th graders, have intentionally taken exceedingly large amounts of cough medicine containing DXM to get high. Alaskans take substance abuse issues very seriously, Madam Chair, as you well know, and the abuse of DXM should be no exception. House Bill 125 seeks to assist in combating this problem by prohibiting the sale of DXM to Alaskans under the age of 18. This step, asking for proof of age prior to sale, would maintain access to effective over-the-counter cough medicines for Americans who use them to treat cough symptoms associated with colds and the flu, while limiting access to the small but notably significant number of adolescents who might abuse them. The penalty to those who sell to minors, Madam Chair, is a fine that would begin at $150 and escalate to $250 in the case of future offenses. We are joined online today by Carlos Gutierrez from the Consumer Healthcare Products Association, who has worked honestly tirelessly on this issue to help keep our children safe, and he can further talk about these efforts.
Representative Foster.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just bought some Sudafed yesterday, and you've got two kinds. You've got the kind that you can buy at the front counter, and then you've got the other kind that's behind the counter. How would this, I guess, fit into that? Is this something that you could just buy at the front counter?
Through the Chair, Representative Foster, as I understand it, and I'm not quite as familiar with the way that Sudafed is regulated, but from having purchased some recently for a flu, not only is Sudafed behind the counter, but it also requires identification be scanned and usually your information be put into a database. I believe this effort was undertaken to track and regulate the production of methamphetamines. However, However, unlike Sudafed, what would happen with dextromethorphan-containing medicines, these would still be available over-the-counter. A cashier, upon purchase, would just have to check an ID or note that a person might be over the age of 25.
And so yesterday when I did purchase the Sudafed, I think you had mentioned I actually had to sign a logbook. But with this, there's no logbook. It's just the ID, correct?
Through the Chair, Representative Foster, indeed. It's just the identity checks. And it is still available to people under the age of 18 with a prescription from a doctor as well as people over the age of 18 who would have to do nothing except possibly show ID upon purchase.
Thank you.
Representative Klayman?
I didn't have any questions.
No, I didn't.
And Representative Lynn, and I'll note that Representative Culver is here in the audience. Okay, Representative Lynn.
Yeah, thank you very much. Need some clarification. I see in Section 1, Line 8, it's very short, I can read it, the seller, retailer, or vendor checks a government-issued photo identification to determine the person is 18 years of age or older. So we had photo ID to buy cough syrup, but not for voting. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Lynn, as best I understand it, yes.
Thank you very much. My point is made.
Thank you. Representative Grunberg and then Representative Keller.
I'll yield for a minute. I may find my answer in the vote.
Okay. Representative Keller.
My question is much lower level than that.
Thank you.
This is the problem is consumption. This isn't something that's being refined and made into a more potent detrimental drug.
Through the chair, Representative Keller, as best I understand, although obviously I am not an expert when it comes to the manufacturer of drugs, this is simply being consumed as one would a cough syrup, just in excessive amounts.
So they don't put it in concentrates, I take it.
Madam Chair, I don't believe they do.
Representative Millett, since it looks like Representative Grunberg has not.
So what's most common, what they're doing, from what I can tell from talking to police officers and other people that are more expert in this drug, is they're taking the cough syrup, mixing it with soda, and drinking it, and called robo-tripping is what the term on the streets are. Consuming large quantities, the health effects are detrimental to these young kids whose bodies and minds are forming, and they don't understand that they're just looking for that quick high, which sometimes turns into much more than a quick high. So that's the thought of the, how you take the drug in large quantities and you robo trip.
Thank you, Representative Grunberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm looking at Section 2 of the bill, Grace. And these are the limitation of home rule powers, if I may just, so people know what we're doing here in Section 2. Only the following provisions of this title.
Wait a second. Are we looking at Section 2 of the bill?
Yeah, line 5.
Okay.
See, it doesn't, for some reason, the drafting style didn't require them to set out the whole section. So all it sets out is subsection 65. You can't tell from the text of the bill what the whole section does. And it apparently is limitation of home rule powers. Only the following provisions of this title apply to home rule municipalities as prohibition on acting otherwise than provided. In other words, they can do anything they want except for stuff that's listed here. And now we have a new section 65. These provisions supersede existing and prohibit future home rule enactments that provide otherwise, and they have now added to the other 64 provisions this new little provision in Section 3, which says that home rule municipalities cannot regulate decks. I'm going to call it decks. And as I understand it, because that's reserved to the state, through the chair. Am I right, Grace?
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, you are correct. And if we look to Section 3, it provides that for other municipalities as well.
Now, I do have another question, please.
Go right ahead.
If the members would look in the bill at lines on page 1, line 10 and 11, lines 8 and 1 are fairly simple. You got to have a governmental issued
photo ID.
Photo ID. But now number two says that the guy behind the counter can still sell it to you if, I mean, if the person's outward appearance would reasonably, the person, if from the outward appearance, the person would reasonably presume this, the customer is age 25 years of age or older. That's kind of unusual. I don't recall seeing any. Did you make this point already?
No.
Oh, you didn't. Are you?
No. I mean, we're okay. Talking about profiling, I guess.
Yeah. That's very unusual and puts an unusual burden on the employee who may just be, frankly, a clerk through the chair. Why is that in there?
Representative Gruenberg, through the chair, this is to say that if someone is notably older looking than the age 25, and we don't pick 18 because the age ranges of 18 to 25 are fairly similar looking oftentimes, but this is to say that if someone is notably older than 25, that were an employee not to, say, card them at the register, that would still be an acceptable form of evaluating someone's age.
Through the chair. You should have seen me at 24.
Madam Chair, Representative Gruenberg would not get carded under this bill. None of us except Neil Foster would get carded under this bill.
I'd like to look at that phrase.
I represent
and hear it
comments.
From the people who are in the industry, and because company could get in real trouble if they did this. I think the reason we have these cards in alcohol beverage and stuff is to protect the employee largely. You just card them, and then there's no question.
Through the chair, Representative Gruenberg, this is also commonplace, and I unfortunately can't cite the specific statutes, but this is commonplace already in the adopted business practices of the major retailers in this state, which is why this language was confirmed by our office once it was.
Yeah, one follow-up.
One follow-up. Then I'd actually like to go into public testimony before we get into the major discussion of the bill.
If I could.
Okay.
Is there a language like this, Grace, through the chair, in other statutes so that, you know, you don't have this thing for this one drug and everything else they've got a card or something? And that could further confuse it, just through the chair.
Representative Gruenberg, through the chair, I may, in fact, call on my lifeline, Casey Schroeder from the Department of Law, who has joined us today specifically for questions like this.
Thank you.
Casey?
For the record, Casey Schroeder, Assistant Attorney General for the Criminal Division at the Department of Law. I hadn't researched that particular language, but I do know, and I don't know if it's still in statute, but there used to be a rule that you had to try to card somebody when they were trying to buy alcohol if they looked like they were under 35. And I don't know if that was just practice or if it was in statute, but this kind of age thing, she said, is not uncommon, the looks.
Representative Gruenberg?
Madam Chair, I think that may be gone now. Used to be that way, and then it got to be too dicey, and they just card everybody. I don't want to see some little clerk, frankly, go to, $150 or something. That's a lot of money.
You know, we can talk about this when we finish public testimony.
If I could ask.
Yes, go right ahead. To Grace or to Casey?
Casey, are you aware of other laws on the books that have dosages related to them? You know, are we starting something here that is very different? We made the exception for drugs that were being refined and everything, but, there's a lot of things out there, I think, in your local grocery store that have a recommended dosage. And what kind of evidence or criteria are we going to use in the legislature for saying, okay, we're going to start carding for that one? How about how about your fats, you know? Maybe we're going to start carding people to see if they're, or, you know, something. I mean, in other words, are we starting something here new in your perspective from the Department of Law?
Through the chair, Representative Keller, this is a little bit of a new thing, but as long as the legislature has a rational basis for doing this, and I think that the record has clearly established a rational basis, then it would be fine.
That could be hard to come by. A rational basis.
Trying to establish one.
I think what Representative Keller might be getting at is not necessarily that it's unconstitutional. Where you'd use the rational basis, but exactly where are we going? Are you going to say, well, if somebody looks like they're overweight, you shouldn't be selling them ice cream? I mean, are we going down that path?
Madam Chair, whether or not you go down that path is solely within the purview of the legislature. And I know that everyone here is aware of other states that have tried to limit people's access to soda, for instance. So that this is something that's been before other legislatures. So, and this is not soda.
Thank you, Representative Millett.
Thank you. So just to, on that point, Representative Keller, I thought long and hard about this, but I think the point here is that we're trying to protect children who, it's not an adult issue. This is children under 18 that can walk in a store and buy something that will severely harm them in large doses because they're attempting to get high, not because they're making something out of it, because it's actually being used in small kids, you know, eighth grade children walking in, and it doesn't prevent, you know, an adult from getting it. We're not saying the adults can't do it. What we're talking about is a section of kids that are using this in a really profoundly harmful way.
Madam Chair, if I could respond, I have no doubt on the honorable, noble intentions of the sponsor.
Noble.
Okay? no problem. But what I do have wonder about is the unintended consequences that may be there with this kind of legislation. And I know this isn't, probably this one isn't for Casey, but it's kind of related, and if the sponsor wants to call up Grace, it'd be fine. But have you looked into, and is there any possibility here of a competing drug company winning because of this legislation? I'm not accusing anybody. Honest, I'm not. I'm just, you know, after you're here a while, you get a tendency to really want to follow the money, right, and look at the unintended consequences. And I think of the, you know, that I think that kind of happened with codeine and you know, some of your cough, cold stuff. And I just wondered if you'd explored it. We're going to get testimony on that, you know. Or like from the vendors and from the of the product, and you know where we're at on that. But
everybody's online, Mister.
Everybody's online. I'll shut up.
Representative Keller.
Got it.
Well, actually, we only have one person online, and it looks like it's Sean Moore from the Consumer Healthcare Products Association. So anyway, at this point, if we have no more questions for either Ms. Schroeder, for Grace, or for the bill sponsor, we'll go into public testimony. And I have online Sean Moore. Sean, would you identify yourself with the record, for the record, and tell us whom you're representing?
Sure. Good afternoon, Chairman Ledoux and members of the committee. My name is Sean Moore, and I'm speaking today on behalf of the Consumer Healthcare Products Association, or CHPA, in support of House Bill 125. I think Grace did a fantastic job of describing what this bill does. Pretty straightforward, but essentially it would prohibit the sale of over-the-counter cough medicine containing dextromethorphan to those under the age of 18. CHPA is the premier trade association representing the manufacturers and marketers of over-the-counter medicines, dietary supplements. We've worked closely with Representative Millett on this legislation, and we commend her for her efforts to prevent intentional abuse of cough medicine. To provide you a bit of context for this issue and how we came to the point of having House Bill 125, Dex is essentially it's the most widely used cough suppressant on the market. It was first developed and approved for use in the 1950s as a non-narcotic alternative to codeine cough medicine. As you heard, a small but significant number of teens use cough medicines with Dex to get high, often by ingesting 25 to 50 times the recommended dose. And to put that into perspective, 25 prescribed dosage is approximately 1.5 5-ounce bottles of cough syrup. So a few years back, the FDA came to industry and I'll say they strongly encouraged us to help reduce the rate of abuse. Otherwise, the federal government would consider more restrictive action. So going back to Representative Foster's question regarding Sudafed and having to sign a law book, this is really an effort to prevent having to go down that road for cough medicines with dextromethorphan, maintaining access for people who, for millions of Americans that use this medicine responsibly, and just controlling or trying to keep it out of the hands of kids who are seeking to intentionally abuse it. Medicine abuse is something CHP and its members take very seriously, and we're engaged in a multi-pronged effort to reduce the number of teens abusing our product. In addition to putting legislation such as this, CHPA partners with groups that specialize in drug abuse prevention, such as the Partnership at DrugFree.org, the Community Anti-Drug Coalitions of America. Now, we also maintain a website, StopMedicineAbuse.org, dedicated to raising awareness and teaching parents to spot signs of abuse. To date, 8 other states have adopted age 18 restrictions, and a handful of additional states are considering doing so this year. Most national retailers are already voluntarily restricting sales to children. So it's really about leveling the playing field, not driving illicit sales to a select number of retailers, and just providing a statewide policy to give parents greater control over the medicines to which their kids have access. PHPA sincerely appreciates your consideration of our position on this issue, and we respectfully urge your support for House Bill 125. I'm happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you. Do we have any questions? Yes, Representative Grunberg.
Sir, yeah, this is Max Grunberg. Do you have a written testimony you could get to us?
The Chair, Representative Grunberg, I sure could submit written testimony. We're represented locally by Mr. Eldon Mulder, so I will pass along to him.
Madam Chair, if Eldon could, just because this was good testimony, I'm interested. Let me ask you, if I may, through the Chair, Mr. Moore, was this language here a model language that you supplied, or is it in force in any other state?
Through the Chair, Representative Grunberg, this is model language that we worked with Representative Millett and Ledge Council to craft so that it would fit into Alaska's statutes. Every state has its own wording and phrasing, but yes, this policy has been adopted in 8 other states to date.
Okay, so we would be the 9th state.
Correct.
Okay, and one other thing. Yes, of course. Do you have a copy of the bill handy?
Yes, I do.
Okay, focusing on lines 10 and 11, is that language on the 25 years of age or older, is that in any of the other states?
Through the Chair, Representative Grunberg, yes. It's generally to provide some relief for, I guess, for people who appear over the age of 25 not having to dig through their wallet or through their purse so that they can purchase the product if they are clearly over the age of 18. And I think most states do use the appearing over to be over the age of 25.
Through the Chair. Looking at the way our alcohol laws have evolved in our state over a long period of time, the trend has been to go the other way and to have a bright line procedure that people get trained on. It's called TAMS, whatever that stands for. And they really train their employees, and there's significant penalties actually against the company and the employee if there's a violation. And I realize you don't have that kind of thing here, but any comment from you as to whether that alternative approach has been considered in these other states, trying frankly to protect the employees? Through the Chair.
Through the Chair, Representative Grunberg, I don't think that we CHPA has a position on that being included. We're trying to make this legislation as make sure that it comes with as little burden as possible for your ordinary consumer. If it was the will of the committee to remove that provision and just make it a black and white card everyone, I don't think that we would be opposed to that.
Thank you.
Representative Millett, did you have a response to?
Well, I have a question that might.
Okay, well, I'm going to let Representative Millett respond first, and then you can answer your question.
Thank you. Through the chair. Representative Grunberg, I would point you to line 14 and on page 2, line 1, who knowingly or willfully violates this section. I think Representative Klayman and I were talking. I think there's no ill intent or there's no, I mean.
No absolute liability.
There's no absolute liability. So I'd be happy if you'd like to take it out, but I don't want to kill the bill on this line, but I think the disclaimer appears on line 1 of page 2 that maybe sets the bar a little less than what you're thinking on the clear line.
I hadn't, through the chair, I hadn't realized that. We can deal with this. I don't
Thank
know.
Thank you. Okay. Representative Klayman and then Representative Keller.
A question for the gentleman on the telephone. Recently, I was in one of our sister states, and I think I went in to buy a bottle of wine, and I went in to buy the bottle of wine, and I walked down and realized that they never asked for my ID because I had become so accustomed here in Alaska that no matter how young I might think I look, they card me anyway. But I get to other states where they may be more on this zone of, okay, if you look like you're over 25, we're not going to card you. And I'm just wondering, is Alaska sort of like the rest of the states where we all try to card all the time, or are there some states that are a little more relaxed in terms of alcohol and recognize they give the clerks some ability to make judgment calls and look around the room and see at least many of the people at the table except Representative Millett and Representative Foster that don't look like they're over 25. Is that common in other states that they aren't hard on the They aren't absolute in terms of carding, or do you know?
Through the chair, Representative Klayman, I don't happen to know. I'm not familiar with the other state statutes regarding sales of tobacco or alcohol or any of those other products. I can say I do travel a lot in my job capacity, and I think here in Washington, D.C., in Maryland, some of the surrounding states, I do recall seeing signs up at the registers that if someone trying to purchase alcohol appears to be under the age of 35, and I think that was referenced earlier, that there is a card that you will be carded. I don't know though whether or not how black and white it is in every state.
Thank you.
Representative Keller.
Madam Chair, first a comment. I think Representative Klayman probably hasn't had an extra experience of his life that I clearly remember. This is a couple of weeks ago when they asked me if I wanted a senior citizen discount. Another kind of profile. And it was more than a couple of weeks ago. The question I have for Sean is, Sean,
I would never ask you that.
did I understand you to say that part of the motivation for this in the other states is a threat of federal action? What was the source of that threat? I mean, what do you know any more about that, or is that just a talk point? Or
sure, through the chair, Representative Keller. So the FDA, as Grace cited, abuse statistics from the Monitoring the Future study, which is conducted annually by the National Institute on Drug Abuse. And the numbers, I believe in like 2008, 2009, of teens that were abusing cough medicine intentionally to get high, those numbers were alarming to the FDA. And the numbers suggested that the trend was increasing. So I believe it was 2010, the FDA held a hearing on the matter, and during that time they considered requiring a prescription for dextromethorphan and other measures such as putting it behind the counter, having people sign a logbook to make it more difficult for everyday consumers to get a hold of. And the was opposed to those measures, and we committed to working to bring those numbers, those abuse rates down. And the FDA strongly encouraged us to bring those down, and so this is one of the parts of our strategy. As I mentioned, we also reach out to parents. We partner with a number of organizations that are whose sole mission it is to reduce substance abuse across the country, and we've been seeing some success. The numbers are coming down. Part of that is that a number of states are adopting the age 18 restrictions. We'd also like to think that there's a strong correlation between how we've ranked up our educational efforts and we're bringing those numbers down. So we think that we're onto something here. We believe it's the right strategy. I also wanted to just add from my earlier testimony that we're not just talking about dextromethorphan here. I mean, these products are generally, if you pick up a package of your cough and cold medicine, it doesn't just have dextromethorphan in it usually. It also has things like acetaminophen, which if you're taking 25 times the recommended dose of a cough syrup that also has acetaminophen, you're getting 25 times the recommended dose of acetaminophen, which is incredibly harmful for your liver. Your blood will be incredibly thin, and it's potentially lethal. So it's things that are unintended consequences of this too, and that's what that I think will get FDA's attention. So I hope that makes that a little more clear. I'm happy to answer follow-up questions if you have any.
Thank you.
Yeah, Representative Grunberg, and then I've got a question.
I think this is generally a good bill. My hang-up is just on that phrase here, sub 2. I don't know how somebody, the standard seems to be on line 1, the legal standard, knowingly or willfully, which I don't know how you can be willful if you don't know. So I think maybe willful is, you know, all you'd have to say is knowing, but if you know the person is under the age of 25, then you can be tagged with a violation. But the standard on sub 2 is whether, from the person's outward appearance, a person would reasonably presume. So you could have somebody that you would reasonably presume to be under the age of 25, but you couldn't be tagged with a violation unless you actually knew it. So there's a difference in standard there. I don't know. At this age, I've seen 14-year-olds who look pretty old, and 65-year-olds who look young, Kayla. But, you know, and many of you here too.
Did you tell old your wife?
She's 18. I'm Jerry Lee Lewis. No.
Madam Chair, when we get to the part where we have committee discussion,
yes.
I would love a friendly amendment from Representative Grunberg. I would take his elder wisdom on this.
There was something else I wanted to ask. Oh, yes, the other thing to Mr. Moore. In this state, the only thing like this I've seen, one thing is with statutory, what called statutory rape. But in that case, the burden is on the defendant. It's an affirmative defense. And I'm wondering if, Mr. Moore, you know, or your legal team knows, is this defense of age supposed to be, or in these other states, is that flipped onto the defendant? Or who had the burden of persuasion, burden of proof on that issue? How is that interpreted in these other states that have the same statute?
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, I am not personally a lawyer, and I don't have the expertise in that field, but I could ask our legal team to look at that and weigh in and provide the committee an answer at a later date.
Thank you. I'm not trying to rag the bill. This has got some issues, though.
So I've got some questions, Mr. Moore. So is most of this misuse for kids who are 8th graders through about 16. I would imagine just realistically at about 16 they start going into other things rather than cough medicine. Because I guess I'm wondering to have the age of 18 so that you can't simply, I mean, you know how to drive and you've got a cough and you can't get some cough syrup. So I'm asking that, I guess, to both Mr. Moore and to the bill's sponsor, representative.
Through the chair, representative, or Chairman Ledoux, pardon me. This is Grace Abbott again, staff to Representative Millett. This doesn't restrict all types of cough syrup, and I think that that occasionally is a sticking point with this bill, that this exclusively puts the onus on simply DXM-containing cough syrup. So if you were 17 and you had a cough and a driver's license, you could go to a Walgreens and pick up cough syrup that just didn't have this additional suppressant with, you know, incredible sedative qualities.
But that doesn't exactly answer my question, in which I was asking whether the problem, how much of a real problem do you have with kids 16 and older? Because it would just sort of seem to me that this would be the kind of problem that you'd have with a really young teenagers. At 16 or over, my guess is they're trying to get booze rather than cough medicine.
Through the chair, this is Grace Abbott again, and I would defer to Sean Moore if he had additional knowledge of studies. From what I saw, the studies simply had an age range, and so I can only anecdotally speak to people over the age of 16 that we've heard of using this drug or using this medicine as a high. However, the age range that we saw was in 8th graders to 12th graders, and 12th graders including 18-year-olds. So as to whether or not this stops at any point, I can't speak to that, and I apologize.
Mr. Moore, do you know the answer to that question?
Sure thing, Madam Chair. Monitoring the future study that was referenced earlier, it covers teens in the grades between 8th and 12th grade. And it actually breaks it out into three different buckets, 8th, 10th, and 12th. And so in 2014, 12th graders were actually twice as likely to abuse this as 8th graders. So the highest rate of abuse is actually among 11th and 12th graders. So it is something that we are seeing in older teens. Again, it's a potential gateway for abusing additional substances down the road. So it's maybe one thing that an older teen might experiment with before moving on. But we are, to answer your question, yes, we are seeing a higher rate of abuse among 11th and 12th graders, so 17, 18-year-olds, 16, 17-year-olds.
Thank you. Appreciate that. So do we have any more questions for Mr. Moore? I would like to close public testimony and also to tell Representative Lynn that he's going to be bringing us donuts.
I didn't mean to talk.
Same thing.
Pass this bill.
Same thing. All right. So public testimony is closed. Let's go into committee discussion. And I guess I'd like to comment with respect to Representative Grunberg's concerns about the clerk who might not tag somebody who is 18, 19, 20. I mean, I think that it would be easier for the clerk. I mean, she could always, I mean, the store could always say, you tag everybody. You ask for everybody's ID. But I mean, when somebody is clearly over a certain age, why does everybody have to go through that hassle? So I guess unless the maker of the bill really wants to change that, I would just leave it the way it is.
Madam Chair, I don't have any problem with this. I think it makes it easier for retail stores. I mean, clearly I'm over 25. And if I don't look over 25,
you want somebody to argue with?
No, what I'm saying, what I'm saying is, I don't want to have to dig in my purse. And if I looked under 25, then there might be reason to card me. But I think we have knowingly and willfully in the statute. I think it's fine as it is. I think it gives a break to the people that are going to be selling decks and. Like you said, it could be a store policy if you wanted to. I don't think it takes away from the bill. I think it just is an easier on the private sector to do a job.
And I would look at the phrase where it says knowingly and willfully, and since it doesn't say that it's an affirmative defense, and we've dealt with affirmative defenses in this committee before, and the laws generally say when something's an affirmative defense, then it's set out in the statute. So it seems to me that it's the burden on law enforcement to show that somebody knowingly and willfully violated the statute. So I don't think it's overly onerous on the vendor. I'm not thrilled myself with one more thing that we're making not quite illegal. But I'm not thrilled with the alternative, which looks like it's going to go the way of Sudafed and be behind the counter. And while I hate to accede to, the will of the federal government, sometimes there's the reality. So that's kind of my view of this. Representative Keller.
Didn't you say, somebody say that there's over 100 products that have this in it, or a large number? And what I'm wondering about is, you say it's not onerous, but the retailer or the store has to sort these things out and set them aside, because otherwise you aren't going to have the clerk reading the fine print, just because the kid is underage, So, how many products are we talking about, and what about the labeling on these things, and
you've got a good point, Representative Keller, Representative Millett, and then Representative Kleiman.
Thank you. On that point, Representative Keller, they can be keyed to alert the cashier, just like Sudafed used to alert the cashier to say that you needed to show ID. There's many products in the stores that alert cashiers that you need to show an ID. Cigarettes is one of them. They code the products with DMX in it. It alerts the cashier. I don't know if you've done it before at the grocery store. Some magazines are coded that way, that you have to be 18 and over to buy, and it rings a bell and off it goes.
Representative Millett, has this been in other committees before?
No.
No. Is it going anyplace else?
To the floor.
To the floor. Just wondering whether there is a retailers association that might have something to say on this.
Madam Chair, I can check with the retailers association and see if it's overly burdensome for them and get back to you before I take it to the floor if you'd like me to.
I actually would like you to.
I would love
Madam
to.
Madam Chair, if I could request the sponsor also ask NFIB, National Federation of Independent Businesses, to see if they have a position on the bill, please.
Yes, sir, I will.
Representative Kleiman?
I just wanted to make a couple of comments. I broadly agree with the chair that when we do these things, the notion that we're going to start shifting into everybody gets carded no matter what, I think really does start becoming onerous for the businesses. And I remember one of the first times when the carding started becoming popular and hearing from a senior citizen who said, I couldn't believe it. I went for a beer at the football game and she really looked at the ID. And I understand that they want to see the ID, but the fact they're actually reading it was fairly shocking to this senior citizen. And the kind of practical reality of what we're dealing with on the drugs, I looked up here on my iPad that what were the ingredients in Robitussin, a fairly common over-the-counter cough medicine, and of course they have both pseudoephedrine and Dex all in the same drug. And it's an example, because I've been as probably most of us have, been to the grocery store or the drugstore looking for cough syrup, and you look through these racks of 15 different cough syrups, you try to decide which one to get, and you sort of generally think probably none of them is going to do all that good a job, but you might as well try something because you got a cough and you want to get over it. And so the concept that we're going to shift into having more drugs that we're going to start having to card for is a challenge. I think it's a challenge for retailers. I think it's a challenge for I think it's both a challenge for retailers and for the public. And at the same time, this is a very real concern. We have kids that are abusing these medications, and I don't think there's an easy solution. I think the bill is very well intentioned, and I'm concerned if we're now talking about 15 different cough syrups that start going behind the counter, retailers might have a very different view.
Representative Bennett.
Madam Chair, Trustee Staff Grace just informed me that Sean is a retailer rep as well, and Fred Meyers and Kars in our communities are already doing this for Dex. So I believe if it was onerous, we wouldn't have voluntary compliance with this already. So maybe they saw the writing on the wall.
Thank you.
But I will check with NFIB.
Thanks. Mm-hmm. Any other comments on the bill? All right. Can I have a motion?
Madam Chair, to the floor. Is that what you want?
Yes.
House Bill 125, version alpha, out of committee with individual recommendations and attached zero fiscal amount.
Seeing no objection, the bill passes. Everybody stay around to sign the form.
So great. I love this committee.
It's 2:20, and we'll be meeting here tomorrow at 1 o'clock to discuss another drug.
Nope.
Adjourned.
If I was a